From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Al Franken about his new sitcom, Late Line, set behind the scenes at a late-night news show. Franken was a Saturday Night Live regular for 15 years and wrote the best-selling book of political satire, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. Also, we talk with novelist Mary Gordon about writing erotic encounters for her new novel, Spending, about a woman artist and the man who becomes her patron, muse, and lover. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Sunday's season opener of The Larry Sanders Show and tonight's telemovie starring Christopher Darden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Farmers in the Southeast are concerned about the unseasonably cold weather now threatening their crops. Farmers are taking measures to protect their strawberry and peach harvests from record-breaking low temperatures. From member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Mike Jansen reports.
Temperatures in the teens and 20s and high winds pose a threat to peach and strawberry crops, which bloomed earlier this year during a warm winter. In North Carolina, more than half of the peach crop has bloomed. Toby Bost, an agricultural extension agent in Winston-Salem, says area farmers are taking a number of precautions.
Growers are using covers, row covers, if you will, on strawberries. They'll be doing some irrigation running through the night to hopefully moderate the temperatures and keep those unopened blooms from freezing.
Farmers from Virginia to Alabama are also using wind machines and heating units to protect their harvests. And in North Carolina, where irrigation nozzles might freeze, some farmers are planning to spend yet another night in their orchards trying to protect their plants. For NPR News, I'm Mike Jansen in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Former Miami Mayor Joe Carollo returned to City Hall today, 4 months after he lost the mayoral election that a court declared rife with absentee voter fraud. The election results were voided last week, and Carollo persuaded an appeals court to return him to office. The appellate court ruled Carollo would have defeated opponent Xavier Suarez if not for the fraudulent ballots. Suarez has vowed to appeal and lead a petition drive to set a new mayoral election in Miami this fall. American military investigators have released their report on an accident last month between a U.S. Marine jet and an Italian cable car. The investigators blame the Marine jet crew for the accident, which killed 20 people. The jet clipped the cords suspending the cable car, spilling the riders to their deaths. NPR's Martha Raddatz says the crew willfully violated regulations.
They have found there was no aircraft malfunction. The Marine Corps said the very first day of this accident that the aircraft, the jet, was flying too low. That was obvious because it ran into the ski cable. But now they are saying the investigators have found that the pilot and the crew were violating clear flight instructions for the mission, that it was a willful violation. Obviously, the goal wasn't to hit the cable car, but that the crew was out having fun, as a senior defense official told me.
The report recommends that involuntary manslaughter charges be considered against the crew. The assassin of Dr. Martin Luther King is in critical condition. James Earl Ray is in a Nashville hospital fighting complications from liver disease. He was hospitalized on Sunday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 30 points at 86.45. The Nasdaq is down a fraction. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is down from record highs. Bloomberg's Doug Krusner reports from New York.
The market is being pressured by overnight weakness in the major Asian equity markets. Japanese stocks were down for a second day on concern about fallout from a bribery scandal at the Bank of Japan. There was also speculation that Fuji Bank is about to cease operations. On the positive side, though, there is strength in retail shares after Dayton Hudson agreed to split its stock 2-for-1. Among the losers is Dole Foods, which has lost more than 10% after the company said first quarter earnings could be about half last year's because El Nino rains caused overproduction of bananas, lowering prices in North America. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government says the broadest measure of the country's trade deficit skyrocketed to $166.4 billion last year. That's the second worst showing ever. The deficit for the last 3 months of 1997 climbed to its highest level ever. The Commerce Department says the report includes trade in merchandise, services, and investments. It was 12.3% larger than it was in 1996, when the imbalance was $148 billion. Many economists predict the red ink will get worse as the Asian financial crisis cuts into American exports overseas. Two of the country's largest stock markets are thinking about merging. The American Stock Exchange says it's reviewing a merger with the NASDAQ stock market. Officials from the American Stock Exchange say they're looking for a deal to combine their auction market with the NASDAQ electronic market to better compete against the well-known New York Stock Exchange. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former Saturday Night Live writer and performer Al Franken has a new sitcom that premieres next Tuesday after Frasier on NBC. It's called Late Line, and it's set behind the scenes at a late-night network news show. Late Line was described in People magazine as the funniest new series of the 97-98 season. Franken not only stars in the series, he co-created the show and co-produces it with John Marcus. Franken was one of the original writers on Saturday Night Live and worked on the show for about 15 years. The character he became best known for was Stuart Smalley, the New Age self-help cable TV host. Franken is also the author of the best-selling book of political satire called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. On Late Line, Franken plays Al Freundlich, the chief correspondent for the show, who has his eye on the anchor chair. I asked Franken to describe his character.
Well, I'm sort of the show putz. Freundlich is the chief correspondent, and he's a good correspondent, but he is not very self-aware, and he's an intellectual, or he thinks he is, and he's actually pretty smart, but and he kind of thinks he's sort of the carrier of the keeper of the Edward R. Murrow torch. But he has he doesn't have very good people skills. And when we went down the Nightline, what I discovered, one of the key relationships at Nightline, and in any news bureau I discovered because we went to other places, was that of the producer with the correspondent. And we heard a lot of stories from producers about high-maintenance correspondents. So I wanted to make Freundlich a very high-maintenance correspondent. But he's kind of a pure character. In an odd way. He feels very passionate about what he does. And as a result, he's willing to spend 20-hour days on stories when 8 hours would be fine or 12 hours would be fine. As a result, his producer, Gail Ingersoll, who's played by Megan Price, is sort of saddled with this guy and is becoming what actually Peter Jennings gave John and I this term, a news nun.
Right, yes. He gives her a whole lecture about how she's becoming a news nun.
Yeah, Freundlich.
Freundlich does, right.
Yeah.
Right. So why do you seem to particularly enjoy playing someone who thinks they're very great and attractive and smart when really they're foolish and always missing the point?
I like playing... Somebody compared the character to Stuart in an odd way, which is
sort of... To Stuart Smalley.
I like someone who's passionate about something, and that sometimes maybe his passion blinds him, but it's at least a sort of a pure impulse. So he's the kind of guy, you know, he feels that the wall between news and entertainment has been eaten away like the cartilage in David Crosby's septum, which isn't fair because mainly he freebased. But the point is still the same, which is Freundlich feels that there's just too much entertainment in the news. So you'll see in our shows that he tends to go for the stories that he feels are important and that people should know about. And there's a tension there between that and the executive producer, played wonderfully by Miguel Ferrer, who is more realistic and understands that you need ratings and you need shows, you need kick-ass TV.
Now, over the years, you've gotten to see how politicians react to jokes about them? Because you've been in the position of talking about politicians for many years in sketches and on stage. And I think it was in 1996 you were performing at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and said something that made Newt Gingrich really angry with you. What did you say?
Well, I said a lot of things probably that made him angry with me, but because I made fun of him. And it turns out he's thin-skinned. But there was one thing he fixed on, which kind of amazed me. And I think it was kind of tactical on his part. I told this joke, which is, I said that, you know, Newt's is nothing if not a man of ideas, some of which get him in trouble. For example, his gender theories. He had said about a year ago at that time in his course, he said that if serving in the military means being in a ditch for 30 days, women have trouble being in a ditch for 30 days because they get infections. So I said, this conjured up an image to me of Newt explaining to his daughter that she, when she was 13, that she had just gotten her first infection. So I told like 10 jokes about Newt that night. A lot of Air Force One stuff, you know, a lot of stuff that I'm sure he didn't like. So I went down to grab my table, and my wife was at a table with some of my friends, and the speaker was at the next table. So I was standing about 5 feet from him, and I thought it would be kind of like a snub if I didn't say something. So I went up to him. I said, I hope you took everything I said in good fun. And he was really mad, like smoke was coming out of his ears. And he said, well, I think you went over the line. And I said, really? What joke do you think went over the line? He said, the thing about my daughter. And I couldn't remember saying anything about his daughter because I didn't think of that joke as a joke about his daughter.
It was a joke about him.
I thought it was a joke about him and his patronizing attitude toward women and his not and the seeming confusion of, well, you know what the joke is. So anyway,
explain the punchline, Al. I'm just kidding.
Well, no, I ended up explaining it to him about 5 times.
Yeah.
So he got really, he said, I said, I don't remember telling a joke about your daughter. He said, the infection. I said, oh, well, that wasn't about your daughter. That was about your attitude toward women. That was about you confusing menstrual 30 days in a ditch. Women can't do it because they get infections. And if infections in 30 days sounds like you're confusing it with a period. And he said, I almost went up there and punched you. I went, oh, no. I said, no. This wasn't about, I don't know your daughter. I don't know anything about her. This was not about your daughter. I don't know. And then he kind of went away. And then I was going to a cocktail party afterwards, the VIP cocktail party. And I ran into him again. And I took him by the shoulders and I said, I'm sorry if you were offended, but let me explain it again. And I explained the joke again, and he finally kind of said, okay, I got it. So that was it.
Well, I guess you're lucky you don't have to explain the joke that many times to your audience.
No, it is interesting to try to dissect a joke to someone who's really angry at you.
Ooh, and who's the subject of the joke.
And who's the Speaker of the House.
So, yeah, right. Did this make you any more reticent about telling jokes about politicians when the politicians are in the room?
No, what it did tell me was that you can't give someone an excuse to find some element of your joke to take offense at and either misconstrue it either deliberately or unintentionally.
Oh, so, but to get themselves off the hook by saying, oh, that Al Franken, he's
well, it was like, you can come after
my daughter.
Yeah, you can come after me, but stay away from my kids.
Right.
He actually said that to me.
Well, would you have rewritten the joke if you knew then what you know now?
I did. I had this became a little bit of a controversy or something, and a reporter from the New York Post called me up and said, "Why did you do that joke?" I explained to her the joke, and Deborah Orin, and then I said, "Well, I probably would have retold it as if I had to do it over again, I'd say, you know, Newt said that if being in a ditch for 30 days means that a woman can't be in the army because a woman gets an infection every 30 days, I would have, the punchline would have been more, this was handy information because my daughter just turned 13 and I would have explained, and I, or my daughter just turned 13 and I explained to her that she had just gotten her first infection.
Right.
So I would have made
right.
my daughter, and she and Deborah Oren goes, well, why didn't you do that? And I said, because I didn't know. The joke was not about his daughter. So this is like for months after this, I would tell this story. This is interesting that you've recalled the story because I've really not told the story in a long time because I was obsessed with trying to explain what a joke is and what you know what the purpose of a joke is.
My guest is Al Franken. His new sitcom, Late Line, premieres Tuesday on NBC. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Al Franken is my guest, and he has a new sitcom that's called Late Line. It's a satire of late-night news shows like Nightline, and it premieres Tuesday.
It's not really a satire.
No,
it's a,
what would you call it?
It's a sitcom. It's sitcom. An ensemble sitcom. I think okay. we're more... The reason I stop you on that is that...
You wanted to hurt my feelings and put me down in a public setting.
Yeah, because it really is a satire, but I just want to... No, it's because I think if people hear that it's a satire, they're going to think, or a spoof, or a parody, or anything, they're going to expect something different, which is maybe they're going to expect a half-hour presentational show that's actually a parody of Nightline. This is a very... about 6 months ago or 8 months ago, I ran into Mary Tyler Moore, and she said, Al, what are you up to? And I said, yet another ripoff of your show.
Right.
And she said, well, there can't be too many, can there? And so that's what we are. I mean, we're an ensemble comedy, and the people we have writing on it, Earl Pomerantz did Mary Tyler Moore and did Cheers and did MASH and did Taxi. He didn't do MASH. He did Taxi. John did The Cosby Show. So this is a sitcom.
I'm sure since you're doing a sitcom about the news and politics that you've been watching CNN a lot lately, and I'm wondering
yes.
if you've been watching Mike McCurry's White House briefings a lot, and how you would kind of grade him in his ability to deflect questions with humor.
He's had a tough job. I wouldn't want the job, but I think he's doing pretty good because he basically, to me. The independent counsel has gotten to a whole area that you shouldn't get into, and so the attorney general gave him the right to do it basically, and so we got a kettle of fish here that I don't know how you deal with. I don't know how you deal with it if you're McCurry, and I since we're doing a show about the press, I've noticed that you saw the feeding frenzy, you saw a kind of rush to judgment, and a lot of people are critical of the press, but there are some news organizations that didn't rush to judgment, and I'd like to give them credit now. Sailing Magazine, American Grocer Monthly, Jugs, Big Butt, and Hustler's Barely Legal all did not... given the temptation of printing salacious material about the president. But I saw saw a show. Now the press is doing their self-flagellation stage. And I saw actually on C-SPAN last night something from the Shorenstein Center on the Press. Marvin Kalb hosted a roundtable called The Press, Constant Self-Reevaluation, Useful Exercise, or Giant Wankathon. And Marvin came down on the useful exercise side.
Have you been trying to keep up with the Monica Lewinsky story?
Yeah. I get my daily fix of it.
Well, I wonder, you know, as a political comic or a comic who often does political humor, what do you think of the idea of the public basically being asked to visualize the president having oral sex? Do you know what I mean? It's like, there's been times when the presidents have been sick and we've seen pictures of the presidential colon on TV as mm-hmm. like the surgeon explains the president's condition. And you
usually
wonder, like,
it isn't
do
really
I want to know about
this? Colon. It's
right,
a,
right.
It's a
diagram.
Of it.
That's
yeah.
right. It's a diagram of a colon.
Yeah.
But the public is basically being asked to think in very
graphic
yeah. terms, yes, about the president. And I wonder what that makes you think about.
Well, as a comedian, you just want to stay away. I want to stay away from it. I don't.
Why do you want to stay away from that?
Because it's too easy. It's basically, you know, there's a lot of basically, it's too easy to do jokes about oral sex, and it's too cheap. But I do a few. You want to hear them? Now, one good thing about it is that it's forced husbands and wives to discuss frankly what does and does not constitute adultery. For example, my wife has told me that she believes oral sex is adultery, which I think explains why we haven't had any since we've been married.
See,
that's isn't that too easy?
Oh,
no, it
funny.
Depends how you do an oral sex joke. That,
right.
I think, is a legitimate oral sex joke.
I don't know where I don't know where you think the line should be drawn for a president between public life and private life, but say that you.
I think they've gone over the line.
Right. So does that mean that as a comic, you shouldn't go over that line too, or do you think that like it's okay to go over that line since it's already been transgressed?
Yeah, I think you can't ignore it. It's just like to some extent, people are blaming the media, blaming it for a lot of this, the reporting of it. But it's an important story. The Independent Counsel is investigating this, and that's an important story. And then as a comedian, you sort of have a responsibility to address it. I try to address it by talking a little off the obvious or a little off the, you know, it's the oral office or that kind of, you know, that kind of joke.
Right, right. When you watch C-SPAN, I wonder what you think of Brian Lamb's almost obsessively neutral interviews. I mean, he's so wonderfully fair. And
I love Brian Lamb. I did Washington Journal with him as part of the publicity for the show. I did it a couple days ago. And he's a great foil for a comedian because he has a policy, which is that he can't laugh.
He can't laugh?
No.
Why would that be showing too much subjectivity?
He believes that if he laughed at a joke, that it could be misinterpreted one way or another. As him having some sort
wow.
of bias. So he has a rule. And I didn't know this. I actually was on a couple years ago to, it was my first appearance to push my book, the Rush Limbaugh book. And I was on with Susan Swain, I think her name is. And I told a joke and I saw her fighting not to laugh. And I I'm a comedian and I'm thinking, No. You laugh. That helps. And
right.
kind of thing. And she tells me on the air, we have a rule. You can't laugh. So then I realized, and then after the show was over, she told me, explained this Brian Lamb rule that you can't laugh. So I was on with Brian the other day, and it's a very liberating thing as a comedian to know the guy can't laugh. Because then you don't know, you know, you're, and I'm seeing his eyes. He's kind of laughing in his eyes, but he's holding back. So it was really a lot of fun. And I got some great... See, C-SPAN also, you get the best callers. They showed some clips from the show before we started the interview. And the first call was from a woman who said, yeah, I watched those clips, and if you think they're funny, not only are you ugly, but you're stupid. So that was a question for me. So I said, Brian, was that your Republican line? And he said, yes, it was. And then for the rest of the half hour, every caller felt the need to say that they thought I was at least somewhat attractive.
So it must have been really tempting to try to break up Brian Lamb in spite of his policy. I mean, what would happen if he or one of the hosts of a show laughed at one of your jokes? Would they have to, like, resign in shame?
He would fire anyone who... I don't know. He kind of almost cracked a couple times. But it was... he really, really, really cares about C-SPAN's purity and not having any bias and not having any perceived bias. So he really cares about this, and I think that's a great thing.
My guest is Al Franken. Well, your news sitcom, Late Line, premieres Tuesday right after Frasier. That must be a very desirable spot to have because Frasier does very well.
Yes, and also I think we're a pretty compatible audience. It's a very funny show and a smart show, so...
So are you going to be, you know, having to watch the ratings really carefully? I guess they'll be watched for you.
Yeah, we'll be having our eye on those things. Since all our shows are in the can already, we have nothing else to do.
Right.
For next year, you know, but it'll all be the numbers, you know. So not all of it, but we've gotten a lot of great critical buzz, so that helps too.
What are you going to do Tuesday night, the night of the debut?
I think I'm just going over to John's house and watching the show with some friends.
John, your co-producer.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Al Franken, his new sitcom, Late Line, premieres Tuesday after Frasier on NBC. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, finding the language for erotic love scenes. We talk with Mary Gordon about her new novel, Spending. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season opener of The Larry Sanders Show and tonight's telemovie starring Christopher Darden. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What artist doesn't feel that his or her work would improve if only they had more time, more space, and more money? In Mary Gordon's new novel, a woman painter meets up with an admirer who offers himself as her patron, muse, model, and lover. The novel explores the impact this relationship has on the painter's work and every other aspect of her life, from money to parenting to sex. In fact, one of the issues we'll talk about is the dilemmas Gordon faced in writing about sex. Gordon is the author of the novels Final Payments, The Company of Women, and Men and Angels. Her recent memoir, The Shadow Man, was about discovering that her father, who died when she was 7, had fabricated much of the story of his life. Here's a reading from the first chapter of Spending. The painter, Monica, is in a gallery giving a slide talk about her work. She's discussing one of her paintings called The Artist's Muse, which shows a man in his underwear in a state of arousal.
That night when I was giving the slide talk, I spoke a little bit about the composition of the painting, but I could tell no one was really interested. What they wanted to hear about was painting an erection. Did I have a model, and who was he, and what did I do to give him one? Was it just one or a lot of them, and how did they last? Except, of course, they were too decorous to ask those questions right out. They did ask the one about the live model, though, which implied all the rest. But I wasn't going to dwell on that. In fact, I didn't have a live model, which accounts for all the brushwork. I did say that, and it got a big laugh. Also, I said, I was painting from memory, in the great tradition of romantic landscape painting, the remembrance of things past. Another big laugh. I'm sure there's an eternal punishment designed for people who are fed by the big laugh, who'll say anything, almost anything, to get it. Or maybe not. Maybe it's not worthy of damnation at all. Maybe it's a very pure act, a very generous act. You give yourself up to your audience, you're all together, carried up on a wave, and you really do lose yourself. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of going for the big laugh or the next big laugh, the wave crashes and I look around me and see only flotsam and jetsam. Old condoms, Tampax holders, empty bags saying Cheetos are made in Taiwan. But that wasn't happening. The wave wasn't even beginning to crash. So I said, you know, folks, there's a tradition that male painters get to take advantage of. The woman who's a combination model, housekeeper, cook, secretary, and of course she earns money and provides inspiration. All over the world, girls are growing up dreaming of being the muse for some kind of artist, looking at their bodies in mirrors thinking, maybe some man would like to paint that, reading French cookbooks that tell them how to make really succulent little dishes out of horse meat with a lot of bay leaves and wine, preparing physically and spiritually to carry his canvases to a hard-hearted gallery owner, their muscles straining, their eyes brimming with shed or unshed tears. Now I ask you, mothers and fathers of America, are your boys dreaming of these things? Where, I ask you, lovers of the arts, where are the male muses? And he stood up just there in front of everyone and said, right here.
Thanks for reading that, Mary Gordon. That's from Mary Gordon's new novel, Spending. Well, this gentleman who stands up and says right here, he not only wants to be this painter's muse, he wants to be her lover, he wants to be her benefactor. What made you think about what it would be like for a woman to have a male muse-benefactor?
I think the general crabbiness that my friends who are artists of one stripe or another have fetched, it's made us crabby, and we've been fetching for years about, you know, why do these guys get this and we don't? When is the balance going to be tipped? And I simply couldn't wait for life, and so I decided to just make it up in art.
What connotations does the word muse have for you?
Well, it has the connotation, of course, of inspiration, but also of that nest of things that is required for an artist to be helped by her or his work. That is to say, someone who provides not only inspiration, but makes a space in the world, gives you space and time, and says, you know, what's important for you is your work. I'm going to make it possible for you to do your work. That's what I think a muse is, or should be.
And what does this guy do to make it possible for her to work?
Well, he gives her money, and so she can quit teaching, and she can feel that she can paint absolutely on her own schedule. She can do whatever she wants. She can travel wherever she wants in case she needs to look at paintings in a particular place. He provides a space for her to live and work in. He provides pleasurable objects for her to be nourished by. And he also is her lover.
Well, once she has the space and the time and the money to devote herself completely to painting, the artist in your novel ends up painting a series that she describes as The Spent Male. But these are also Jesus paintings. You want to describe the work that she does?
Yeah, painter, whose name is Monica, is looking at her lover one night after they've made love, and the posture in which he's sitting seems familiar to her in a puzzling way. And it occurs to her that the way that he's sitting reminds her of a painting by Carpaccio of the dead Christ. And she has a revelation. She says, my God, maybe these dead Christs in Renaissance paintings weren't really dead. They were just post-orgasmic. And she decides to do a series of paintings based on the Italian masters called Spent Men of her lover in a post-orgasmic condition, but using the iconography of Christ in the Renaissance paintings.
What made you think of this?
I was looking at a show of Pontormo drawings in London one time, and I said, this guy's not dead. This guy's just been worn out from a hot night. And it was an absolute perception that amused me. What's really interesting is the Northern Christs look much more dead than the Italian Christs. And I just had fun thinking about that.
Mary Gordon, your early novels seem to be mostly about characters who were very repressed and very guilt-ridden about responsibilities to family, about other responsibilities. This character, it just wants to be totally absorbed in her paintings. And she, there's a lot of sexuality in the new book. Many scenes where the painter and her lover are engaging in acts of passion. And I'm wondering, it seems to me your characters are becoming less inhibited and more sexual. And I'm wondering what that says about you as a writer as you're writing more about sexuality.
One of the things that I, again, wanted to rewrite, and I think maybe one of the things that I feel I stand for or wish to stand for more as a writer and I don't know, a human being, although the two are not necessarily unlinked, is I am very tired of duality. I'm very tired of an either-or. And it seems to me if literature gives us anything, it's the opportunity to say not either-or, but yes-and. And so this character is, she's really committed to her work. She loves her work. She gets irritated if people get in the way of her work. But when her daughter gets mono, she puts her work down. She's a little crabby about it, but she does it. When her lover throws his back out, when her lover loses money and gets depressed, she is there for them. Not without ambivalence, but I guess I wanted to undo what I think is a particularly male fantasy about the artist, which is that there's this tremendous split between life and art, and that being a good person or a responsible person necessarily cuts into to your artistic life. And I think that's a myth.
Let's get back to sex, though.
Okay.
Your character has a lot more sex than I think, you know, most of the characters in previous books have, and she's very comfortable with that. And I'm wondering if you are more comfortable as a writer writing sexual scenes than you would have been early on as a writer.
I think that writing about sex is a little bit hard, and you have to feel your oats a little bit as a writer to feel that you have a right to do it. One of the things that I didn't realize till after I was finished was worrying about not being seen as a good girl writer anymore. That everybody had sort of thought of me as you know, really serious and really taking the moral high ground. And I was really writing about pleasure, particularly sexual pleasure. And while I was doing it, it was an interesting formal problem for me in a way, and something I was interested in writing about, so I wasn't worried about it. And it was only after the book was over that I realized that I was worried about not being seen as a serious good girl anymore. I think I probably couldn't have done that when I was younger. I think one of the hopeful things about getting older is you get less worried about being thought of as a good girl.
You know, your character, Monica, says that she hates talking about sex. She says, most words that connect up with sex have one kind of bad effect or another. Either I laugh or I want to become a Carmelite. Slang is not good. Scientific names are not good either. Then she runs down some of the names used for female genitals, and she thinks one sounds like a gum disease and another sounds like it was invented in the men's room of a bus station. How did you find the right words that you wanted to use, that you were comfortable with, that sounded sexy and not condescending or insulting to you? Because so many words, slang words that are used to describe women's bodies end up sounding nasty.
They do, and it was a real problem. I had to go through a lot of revisions, and finally I did do the slightly cop-out thing of saying I'm not going to use any of these words because they're tainted. But I realized that in my own conversation, I rarely would use those kinds of words. So I fudged it in that way. But I also was very interested in creating a new erotics that was really female. And it seems to me that female erotics are much more contextual than male erotics. And one of the things I did was I read a lot of Colette. And Colette very rarely names anything, but she creates a situation in which the objects surrounding the events are so erotically charged that they begin to give off a kind of musk of their own. And I realized I could be more explicit than Colette could be, but I wanted to create a sexualized, an eroticized, a richly voluptuous context so that the sex came from a place, not just sort of appearing from nowhere. And yet I didn't want to be coy. I didn't want to say, now we're going to draw the curtain. And so that was kind of a challenge.
Mary Gordon is my guest, and her new novel is called Spending. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Gordon, and her new novel is called Spending. Now, you're writing about a comparatively older couple in this. The woman has already gone through menopause. So, you know, birth control isn't an issue for her. Pregnancy isn't an issue. She says, I was too old now to lose anything by it, to lose anything by sex. I almost certainly couldn't even get pregnant anymore. One of the things we could both count on was that we were past many things that once might have been at stake. Talk to me a little bit about that about writing about a couple that's older and is engaged in first-time sexual encounters with each other.
This is something that I'm actually rather hopeful about, and you know, my nature is not to be so hopeful. But I think that, and again, I'm talking about people who are fortunate, and I understand that a lot of people have had terrible situations. But I think that there is a cohort of us who went through the sexual liberation of the 60s, went through the women's movement. We have our own identity through work, not just through who we are in the eyes of men. We're not young, but we're still peppy, and we might even look good. Some of us, oddly enough, look better than we did at 20. And I think that because, you know, a lot of us know, even if you made a sexual mistake, your life is not going to be ruined by it. I mean, unless you get killed, which is another popular motif in writing about women and sex. But supposing that you don't get killed, you have too much in your life that's in place to have it ruined by sex. And that, in conjunction with some of the other good things that have accreted through a life, gives you an odd new freedom and energy sexually, I think.
So you're talking about all the anxiety that was involved for a lot of women in their early sexual encounters, where it was related so much to their personal identity and to fear of getting pregnant, fear of being found out, fear of being hurt.
Fear of being hurt, fear of marrying the wrong person or not marrying the wrong person or not getting married or, you know, getting, as you say, getting pregnant or not getting pregnant. And once you... being beloved, and if you're not beloved, then you were a whore. All those things are, if they're out of the way, there's a lot of nice open space.
Over the past year or so, there's been a lot of controversy about the form of the memoir. Are writers being honest when they write about their lives? Are the memories that they have accurate memories? Do the writers become exhibitionists by, you know, not only revealing intimate details about their own lives, but intimate details about the lives of friends and family who are unwillingly being drawn into a public eye? Is there no longer any discretion about issues that remain private? You wrote a memoir before writing this new novel, and I'm wondering if you felt that there were any surprising after effects from having revealed very personal things about yourself and your family.
Well, I was in an odd situation with my family, in which practically everybody was dead that I was writing about. And my mother is suffering from a very advanced form of dementia. And so, you know, she had no memory and really no awareness that I was doing this. The fallout from this book was surprisingly positive and wonderful, extra literary, in that I found a new family. I hooked up with some distant cousins of my father's, and who have really embraced me and taken me in and given me a kind of connection to that Jewish part of my life that I hadn't had. So again, I was very lucky. I didn't feel that I was revealing anything that could hurt anybody. And so the fallout from it was completely positive. And some people were shocked about things that I said about my mother. But on the other hand, many people who were experiencing a kind of thing that I had experienced with my mother, which is seeing somebody falling apart through dementia or Alzheimer's, were very, very grateful to me for having named the things. So again, I had this odd, you know, I'm often in very odd situations in my life, which are lucky. So is it lucky that practically everybody in your family is dead? You know, maybe that's an odd kind of good luck, but for writing a memoir, the dead are a lot less trouble than the living. And then I got this wonderful, wonderful gift of a new family.
You mentioned that with these newfound family members who have embraced you, you've learned more about the Jewish aspects of your family. Your father was Jewish, and although, as you later found out when you were writing your memoir, he had written some very anti-Semitic things. Your mother was Catholic, your father died when you were 7, and you were raised Catholic and spent a lot of your girlhood, I think, expecting to become a nun.
Mm-hmm.
So what has it been like for you to learn more about the Jewish side of your family?
As I get older, I'm really interested in a life of amplitude. And so as I explore the part of my history and connection that's Jewish, it doesn't seem to be a conflict with the Catholic part. It seems to me they're in dialogue with each other, and their very contradictions are for me enriching and opening up. And one of the things I was trying to write about in Spending is a world of enrichment and a world of complexity and I guess what William James called the buzz and bloom of implication. And it's something that I feel literature can do that nothing else can do, because the opposite of literature is not life, but the soundbite. And this, what does the soundbite do? What do religious fundamentalists do but flatten the world and make it less complicated? And I think ideally as you grow older, you see how complicated it is and how much more rich it is than you ever would have dreamed when you were a kid and you were really, you know, on a mission.
Is religion for you now a kind of cultural, intellectual expression, or do you practice any aspects of Catholicism or Judaism?
I do go to church. You know, I try to go to churches that aren't going to put me into a murderous rage, which, if you're Catholic, is not always easy. I go to the synagogue on the High Holy Days as a kind of witness and touching in. But I definitely think of myself as a Catholic, having been estranged for many years and coming back largely through meeting like-minded people who offer me a more complicated and, I think, more mature and richer and more humane and more humorous version of the church than is coming out of the Vatican right now. So I have a religious life that's important to me. One of the things that I like about a religious life is in church, you see people that can all be together in one place that wouldn't be together in a building for any other reason. And I like being in a place where you don't have to be distinguished to get in. You don't have to earn your place there. You don't have to be good looking. You don't have to be smart. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be successful. You don't even have to be sane or clean. You just have to be there. And I like being sort of under a roof with people who are very different, who are all aspiring to, in general, the same thing.
Well, Mary Gordon, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Mary Gordon's new novel is called Spending. Coming up, David Bianculli previews tonight's telemovie starring OJ prosecutor Christopher Darden. This is Fresh Air. Our TV critic David Bianculli is going to take a look at two TV shows, ones that he says really do range from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Let's start with the sublime. Gary Shandling's HBO series, The Larry Sanders Show, which begins its latest and final season this Sunday. I know much of the country is delirious with Seinfeld fever, counting the weeks until that show is over. But to me, losing Larry Sanders is just as great a loss. This series about a fictional TV talk show host is, and always has been, a very mature situation comedy. There's no laugh track, so you get to decide what's funny, and a lot is funny. The language is raw, and so are the characters. Shanling's Larry is so neurotic, flawed, and rude that he's more like the villain than the hero. Rip Torn as his manager Artie and Jeffrey Tambor as his sidekick Hank have equally rough edges. In other words, they're more like real people than cuddly TV characters. The plots, too, are wonderfully believable and track the real tensions and battles in the late-night talk shows with the feel of a documentary. Jay Leno's been on Larry Sanders as himself, and so has David Letterman, and real-life people and problems pop up all the time on The Larry Sanders Show. In Sunday's season opener, for example, Larry and his manager Artie are forced to take a meeting with some very concerned network executives who are worried because Larry's ratings, in some cities, are dipping as low as those of a very weak rival, Keenan Ivory Wayans.
We've got a situation here. Okay, in certain key cities, you're losing to Keenan. Listen, the bottom line is we've got to do a little fine-tuning to get the numbers up.
Our research department has come up with some really creative ideas. These are just a few suggestions. Mm-hmm. Number one, we'd like to see a more enthusiastic Leno-type opening where you run through the audience and shake everyone's hand.
You know, that's how you get the flu.
You could wear rubber gloves.
That's true. And then I could check their prostates, too.
And we get more VR's audience.
Earlier this week, but long after this Larry Sanders episode was written and taped, Wayans' series was canceled in real life. That shows just how close to the bone Shanling's sitcom is cutting. According to Shanling, this season's shows are going to be all about Larry announcing his retirement and obsessing over his final program, trying to make it bigger and better than Johnny Carson's. Sounds like a great concept, and I strongly urge that you make a point of tuning in for this final season. Even more strongly, though, I urge you do everything to avoid tonight's ABC telemovie, Crimes of Passion, One Hot Summer Night. This is one very awful movie, and the worst thing about it is former O.J. Simpson prosecutor Christopher Darden, who stars, as a homicide detective. He is so bad in this, he makes co-star Erica Alaniak from Baywatch look good by comparison. He's so bad, it sounds like he's auditioning for the role of Hal in a remake of 2001 A Space Odyssey. He's so bad, well, don't take my word for it. Listen.
Sorry to bother you at such an hour, sir. I'm Detective Mingus. This is Sergeant Clark. May we come in?
Yeah. Come on in.
Richard? Who is it?
Are you Mrs. Arthur Brooks?
Yes.
Your husband's maid said you might be here. I'm afraid I have some bad news, ma'am.
What's going on?
Your husband, Mr. Brooks, was murdered about 2 hours ago.
What?
Happened at the mansion. Looks like an armed robbery. Whoever did it knew exactly where to go and what to do.
Oh, my God.
Under the circumstances, sir, would you mind telling me your relationship to Mrs. Brooks?
I'm her attorney.
That's convenient.
I hate that Darden gets to turn his courtroom celebrity into a vanity stunt like this. But I love that he's so horrendous, this is probably the last we'll see of him. Unless, that is, he wants to take over O.J. Simpson's role in the next Naked Gun movie. At this point, not even that would surprise me.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.